Hello, my name's Craig Barton, and welcome to the Tips for Teachers podcast, the show that helps you supercharge your teaching one idea at a time. This episode, I have the pleasure of speaking to maths teacher and author all the way from New York, Michael Pershing. And if you've heard Michael on my podcast before, you know you're in for a treat. Four quick things before we start. Sponsor slots for the podcast are open, so if you want to let the world's most interesting listeners know about your book, product or event, just drop me an email. You can view videos of all Michael's tips on the Tips for Teachers website. These are great to show in a departmental meeting or a training session. You can sign up to the Tips for Teachers newsletter to receive a tip in your inbox most Monday mornings to try out with your classes in the coming week. And finally, if you find the podcast useful, I would be ever so grateful if you could take a moment, ideally now, just pause the podcast and give us a lovely review on your podcast player of choice. Thanks so much. Okay, let's get learning with today's guest, the wonderful Michael Pershing. Spoiler alert, here are Michael's five tips. Tip one, begin your explanations as a series of questions that everyone can answer. That's kind of the opposite of what I do, which I like. That's what I like about that tip. Tip two, the best feedback is a learning activity and it's much better than written feedback on the page. Tip three, get used to asking what if after explaining something. I absolutely love that one. Tip four, use partner work as a chance to recruit quiet kids to share their thinking. And finally, tip five, end every conversation with the student saying something smart. It's an absolute cracker, this one, I promise you. So if you look at the episode description on your podcast player or visit the episode page on tipsforteachers.co.uk, you'll see a timestamp to each of the tips so you can jump straight to anyone you want to listen to first or re-listen. Enjoy the show. Well, it gives me great pleasure to welcome Mr. Michael Pershing to the Tips for Teachers podcast. Hi, Michael, how are you?
I am great.
That's very good. Right, Michael, for the benefit of listeners, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, ideally in a sentence?
Absolutely. My name is Michael Pershing. I live in New York City, where I work as a classroom mathematics teacher for children, and I am also a writer about mathematics, teaching, and other
Amazing.
Things also.
Fantastic. Well, let's dive straight in. What is tip number one today?
Tip number one is something that I only realized a couple months ago, I think, and it's to begin explanations as a series of questions that most people can answer. Maybe everybody in the class can answer.
This is an interesting...
That was a complicated sentence. Should I say that again?
I'm loving it, Michael. I like the dramatic pause you left there. It's perfect because it's idealist because it's, as we often chat about explanations, we have similar things but different things, and this is definitely different. So tell me how this plays out and tell me why you do this.
So here's what I realized. What I realized is it was during a lesson. I teach young kids and older kids, just as a funny thing about my school. So I teach third graders here. Is one of the classes I teach, and those kids are, what are they, eight, maybe nine, or is it seven or eight? No, wait, my son is seven, so let's say eight or nine. So they're on the young end. I was getting ready to teach a lesson about symmetry, and the first thing I tried, the first thing that came out of my mouth was, today we're studying symmetry, class, and symmetry is, and I immediately, I backed off in my head. I saw their poor ashen faces, how sad they were that I was diving in like that. And I took a step back then, and I said, okay, wait a second. Tell me a shape that you could fold in half. And that went much better, because then all the hands went up. And I suddenly had a class that was thinking. And thinking in the right direction also. And thinking about things that would be necessary to think about before you could understand what symmetry is. So then I started doing that more often, and I was doing a lesson about algebra with some older kids, and it was about systems of equations, and I said, oh, I know what to do now, and I said, tell me two numbers that add up to 10, and they did. They told me, and everybody in the class could do that, even the students who would have found it hard for me to start with variables in an equation would have found that hard. If I had written x plus y equals 10, what are two numbers that satisfy this equation? there are some students in my class who wouldn't have been able to answer that. So that's when I started thinking, oh, what I should really do is, before I explain anything, I should try to translate basically as much of the explanation as I can into questions. And ideally, it's questions that at the very beginning, everybody can answer, so that I have given everybody kind of a clear signal that they can be part of this. And there's probably cognitive benefits to that also, right? Besides the kind of engagement stuff, I imagine.
I love this.
You know, you're saying to kids, you're reminding kids of things. So that's my tip.
Right, well, let's dig into this, Michael, because I love this. But as I say, it's different to what I do. But I think I get the feeling you're right on this.
I don't remember what you do. I've read your books, and yet I can't remember. I'm sorry. Please tell me.
Well, I'm very much kind of, this is the way you do this. Listen to me really carefully. Now you do it. In a nutshell. But what I want to dig into here with yours is, are these questions your kind of prerequisite knowledge check, or is this a different thing? Are you, like systems of equations is a good example. Are you assessing beforehand? They know what a variable is. They know how to, you know, add two equations together. Has that come before? And then these questions are kind of to engage and get them into it? Or is this, are they much the same?
I don't know. That's a great question. I feel they're very similar territory, right? I think that's what you're picking up on. It feels like a lot of different types of lessons benefit from a slow ramp up, right? Where you have something like this, even if it's not exactly this. I don't think of them as the same way, but maybe I should, right? Maybe I should think of this as the preamble, a kind of a check for understanding of prerequisite knowledge before I dive into a worked example or an explanation or modeling something. But that's not how I think about it. The way I think about it is, when I'm about to explain something, I need to slow down. When I'm about to open my mouth and explain something to kids, I need to translate that. And maybe what that's doing is like you're saying, reminding myself, maybe the reason why that works is because it's checking prerequisite knowledge or kind of reminding kids of prerequisite knowledge. But I think it might be more. I think it might be also because it's an invitation to join in. It's a clear signal you are going to understand this. It's a way to I love it how in English we say pay attention, as there's like, oh, as if there's currency involved. It's almost like you're putting down some money on attention, and now you're invested. If you want to take the metaphor further, so that's kind of how I think it. But you know, the thing is that a lot of things in teaching, it feels like when they don't work, it's because of a couple reasons. And when they do work, there's a couple ways to see it. You can see a lot of things socially or cognitively. So should we see this as reminding students of prerequisite knowledge, or should we see it as inviting students to participate? I don't know. They kind of sometimes feel like very hard to separate. They always happen together in teaching. Yeah. Or most of the time they do. I guess you could tear them apart at the edges.
It's really interesting this, Michael. It feels to me like if I was to build this into the way I do things, then it feels to me like it is a little bit different to prerequisite knowledge in a really good way. Like I think your symmetry one's a good example of this. Like asking kids, can you think of a shape that you can fold in half? That feels to me a very different than a prerequisite knowledge check. That feels to me, as you say, I like this idea of this invitation that you're part of what's about to happen, this new knowledge. So it feels like this could kind of sandwich in between. And my concern with making this a prerequisite knowledge check is the thing with prerequisite knowledge checks that I think anyway is you need to get mass participation. You've got to get all the kids responding, because if you don't, then there's a real danger. You start making assumptions that just because one child knows this, everybody knows this, and that's bad news anyway, but particularly for prerequisite knowledge, because then the whole deck of cards could fall apart. So I'm interested in how you're kind of collecting responses in this, what I would consider kind of this middle phase, where you're asking questions as part of your explanation. Is it one-to-one? Is it whiteboards? How does that play out, Michael?
It's not systematic. I mean, it could be systematic. But I'm thinking about this third grade class where they were often transitioning between things. The way this works is for these little kids, I come into this classroom and they're in the middle doing something with their homeroom teachers. And then I come in and I say, hey, it's math time. Mathematics time, math's time. It's time to, you know, to do some arithmetic or whatever. And so I'm really sensitive to gathering attention and having it feel as fun and communal as what was happening before. So often what, and the other thing about this that I want to say, just in response to your question, is my addled brain sort of like remembers things that I wanted to say in the wrong order. So I'm sorry about that. But the other thing I wanted to say was, part of asking a question that everyone can answer is that it's an easier question. So how do you deal with that? It's not engaging for a very sharp child to be asked a question that's much too easy for them. So the way this would often work is I would say, you know, maybe that symmetry question. Tell me a shape that you could fold. Actually, I'm going to go with the other one. tell me two numbers that can add up to 10. And I would look in my around the room and I'd try to see as many hands up and I'd be like, Daisy. And I'm calling on Daisy because Daisy never raises her hand and she, you know, often has a hard time in math class. So Daisy, go first. 8 and 2. Brilliant. Who's got another one? I'm picking another kid. Okay. And maybe that's Mark. And Mark is, you know, 5 and 5. Amazing, Mark. I'm writing it on the board. And then I see, you know, Oliver. Oliver has his hand up. And Oliver is an all-star. So I call on Oliver. And Oliver says, 5 and 1/4 and 4 and 3/4. And I say, great. And I write that down. And I want to honor the fact that he's thinking. So I would sometimes ask like a follow-up question in that case. I would say, that's amazing. And how did you know that? How did you figure that out? How did you decide that it was going to be that? I mean, I noticed that that's smaller than 5. You went, 4 and 3/4. Can you say a little bit about that? Trying to show that to those kids in the class because there's this contract that you need to have, right? The promise I'm sort of making here with this activity is I'm promising kids who often have a hard time in math class that they're going to be able to understand what happens. And I'm promising also to kids who feel sometimes as if the class is moving too slow for them, or if they've got it already, that I'm promising you're going to learn something too, that you're going to have to think hard also. So I'm trying to promise everybody that good stuff is coming.
This is great, Michael. But just one final question on this. You know, I'm always intrigued by the way you do worked examples where your students study the completed worked example, read it, then answer the self-explanation prompts and so on. How would that fit in with this? Would it be a kind of series of these kind of almost kind of warm-up or participation questions? And then it would be, okay, now here's a new thing for you to study. What's the transition between the questioning to the studying the example look like?
I think it's exactly like you said. And it ties to what we were saying earlier, which is that things like this, things like these invitations or these opener questions, more open questions, are a frequent part of instructional models. When you look around, it's almost like a part of everybody's paradigm. It's a good idea that a lot of people have, is that one way or another, you want to start with something more accessible, either for cognitive reasons or for social. So with worked examples, I'm thinking, hey, there's a lot of, I know where we're heading and I want us all to notice stuff that is going to be necessary for the worked example. I want us to remember the things that are going to show up in the worked example, perhaps. So it might be more tightly connected to prerequisite knowledge. And then I would say, well, everybody, we've just found a bunch of numbers that add up to 10. Now, what if I also told you that the difference between, I'm thinking of two numbers that add up to 10 and the difference between them is 3. How would you find that? Let's study an example. Let's look at how one student did that and then we're on to the next thing. But in a way that's right, because worked examples is what we do, I think, typically for when we want to teach a procedure, right? Or a strategy. And explanations, I think of as we want to explain what a category is or what a concept is. And that's part of like the parallel worlds thing here. Like in the worked example procedural world, the way I think of it is if I'm trying to teach kids a skill or a procedure or a strategy, I'm in the worked example world. And I want to start with some sort of prerequisite question that'll help them notice and remember knowledge. And then we're going to go to a worked example. And then I guess what I'm saying with this tip is it's broader than that, right? The same kind of two-part thing applies more broadly. Whenever you're trying to explain anything, it's good to start with some questions that everybody is able to answer. because of all the reasons we've been saying. So if I wanted to teach kids what a triangle was, I would, the concept of a triangle, I kind of just committed myself to something that I don't know how to do. I've got young kids. but I suppose what I'd do is I'd say, what are all the things you can make with three lines? What are all the shapes you can make with three lines? And I'd say, and the kid would raise their hand and say, a triangle. I'd be like, great, I'll draw it on the board. And then I'd say, what else can you do? And maybe someone would say, I don't know, just like three lines at the center. And we'd do that. And we'd say, okay, these things now I want to teach you. Some of these things are triangles and some of them are not. Just being rigorous about, in my head, remembering to open up the question in the beginning is, I suppose, what this is.
I love it, Michael. It's definitely one I'm going to need to reflect on this. I don't think I involve my students enough. I like this almost, this invitation. This is definitely someone I need to reflect on. Love it, Michael. All right, what is tip number two, please?
Tip number two is another hard one. Hard one, one. A hard one tip. Okay. All right. It's tip number two is the best kind of feedback, in my experience, the best kind of feedback to offer a student or a class when there's mistakes or when there's errors or when there's things that they haven't done right. The best type of feedback is a learning activity. And it's not even close. It's much better than written feedback on a page of their work. In my experience, learning activities are better feedback than writing comments on a page, and it's not even close.
I like it. I love nothing more than a kind of definitive okay. answer. This is good, Michael. Give me some examples of this, how you might use this and to sell your argument.
Absolutely. Well, I started reading research. I've been a teacher since 2010, and I try, in my own way, I was reading research back then. I think I ramped up over the first couple of years. I went from reading, like Paul Tuff's books, I don't know if you know who he is, pop psychology, mindset things, and I kind of ramped up to like finding my way around research papers and stuff, and then, I said, I'm going to understand now. I want to understand all the research about feedback, and I want to think about, I know I could be doing better, so I want to understand this. So at first, my project was, I'm going to learn how to write the best comments ever on pages. I'm going to understand how to take a stack of quizzes or a question that I've collected from the class, and I'm going to write the thing that'll work. And I will write it on that page, and it will lead to learning. That's what will happen, because I'd read that feedback was immensely impactful and super important, and I wanted to do it. I wanted to do the thing that is the best. I wanted to master that part of teaching. It would lead to better learning. It would turn mistakes into learning. And so I started reading, and I started looking for things, and I started writing them. And I would take a lot of time, and I'd write a lot of comments, and inevitably they'd still go in the garbage. The comments on the papers after I was done, students wouldn't always read them carefully. And I said, why is that? Why is this at all? And then I kept reading research. And I read Dylan Williams writing about research and formative assessment. I know he's a friend of the podcast. and he pointed me to Kluger and Denisi's writing about research, writing about feedback. And from them, I got something that what I took to be like a very direct question about feedback, one that made me basically give up on my project of writing comments, because the question was, how does feedback work, and how could it work, really, right? You don't usually teach a class the first time by writing comments on the side of the page, right? You don't do that. I don't do that. I don't say, okay, class, here's some comments. Here's a piece of paper that says how you're supposed to do this. You don't do that. I don't do that. It's a bad idea. No one would pay attention to that. So what are you doing? So you're either, Kluger and Denisi said, in terms of understanding feedback, and really they were trying to understand why feedback sometimes backfires so often in so many of the research studies that were done at the time, and why it works sometimes. And what they ended up saying, which was very clarifying to me, is like, look, And it's funny what you pick up from research, right? This is not the point of their paper, but this is what I took out of it. They said, conceptually, you're either teaching by giving feedback. That's one thing that you could be doing, providing new information to students, helping them understand something they didn't understand before, or you're motivating them. Literally, what else is there? What else could you be doing when you're writing a comment on a page? So your comment on the page must either be teaching kids something or motivating them to study harder or to pay better attention or something like that. And I'll say just on the side, there is a third purpose that comments can have, I think, which is you're showing that it's not directly tied to learning, right? You're showing, I read your paper. I value what you did. You put in a lot of time to this project, or you wrote this essay, and I read it, and I valued it, and there's good things here, and there's things that could be better. But we're learning. It could have a different role, is what I'm trying to say. But if it's just about teaching and learning, it has to be. There's not much else. You're either providing instruction or motivating. And I asked myself, what am I doing with these comments? And it wasn't good instruction, and it was clearly unmotivating. So I said, what else can I do? And then I started thinking, wait a second, how do I teach? How do I teach? If it's instruction or motivation, I don't really know how I motivate. I don't have as systematic thoughts about that, but I do have a pretty clear idea of how I teach things. So I said, okay, so what do I have to teach? And that changed things for me. Then I changed the questions I was asking. When I saw a pile of quizzes with mistakes, I started asking myself, what could I teach? What is the thing here that... and there's always something to teach, more or less. So I started looking at the kids' papers, their quizzes, their homework, whatever it happens to be, and I started looking at it for the eye of, I would like to do a follow-up lesson tomorrow to give feedback. I would like to. I would prefer if everything was perfect and they understand it, and then they're like, oh, you're the best teacher in the world, we love you. Yeah, fine, but realistically... I'd love to teach a follow-up lesson the next day with a learning activity of some kind that could be easily modifiable, so I can get like mega specific about what I need to teach, and I would teach it. So that changed what I started doing. I started looking at these papers and I tried to get very specific. The assumption being that they understand some things. I shouldn't just repeat the instruction I did before. I tried to focus in on, say, okay, they know how to solve Pythagorean theorem problems. In these cases, perhaps, this is a common thing that I think a lot of teachers experience, perhaps when the hypotenuse is missing. But a lot of the mistakes are when a leg is missing. They still square both sides and add them. It's maddening. So that's the thing that they need to learn. So my lesson tomorrow will be a quick lesson about that. And there are easily modifiable formats. Worked examples are one of them, but there's others too, where I've got instructional activities that I can do and I can just kind of like slot in the thing I need to teach. And I started doing that, and I started seeing learning more, which made sense because I was now doing teaching the way I usually do it, not the kind of weird way where you kind of write down in a sentence 40 times and hope the kids learn from that sentence. And I think that's much better. And you can't crumple up and throw out my lesson because you're there for it. You can't throw it on the floor. I don't have to pick up my lesson that I've taught, you know, from the garbage and look at my carefully crafted comments, like sitting with a very sad face, like the toys in Toy Story at the end in the garbage, as kids left the room. So that it's a win.
Right, Michael. Well, I've got one reflection and then one question for you on this one. So my reflection is, when I read similar research, I thought, right, if I improve my written comments to set kind of follow-up work for kids to do, like almost like come up with a worked example for one of the questions they've got wrong in their book and then set them almost like a your turn, that would be great. The problem is it took so long to do and still some of the kids weren't particularly engaged in doing it. So just like you, I thought, okay, I need to scrap this. It's not working. So let's go to what we probably call in the UK like a whole class feedback model. So we look for these kind of common trends and issues within a, you know, a set of assignments or homework, and we address the big ones in front of the whole class. But I'll tell you the kickback I always get on this, Michael, when I start talking about this, and I'm hoping you can answer this for me. is what do you do about the kids who don't need that whole class feedback? What do you do about the kids who have nailed their assignment, they've got it all sorted, they're ready to move on, and yet you are spending valuable lesson time with the rest of the class? Well, what's your response to that?
Well, Roy, how much time are we devoting and what are we doing is, I guess, the question. When I have done this, what I've tried to do is not repeat instruction, but to give more specific instruction on a more specific aspect of the mathematics, or whatever the skill happens to be, right? My model for this is that we're always trying to teach. I'm tracing a circle, a blob area with my pencil, right? If we're always trying to nail an original instruction, we're trying to teach kids a skill of a constrained area, and it's not the biggest we could possibly do, and it's not the smallest either, because we're trying to find the right size skill to teach, we don't want them to just be able to write one kind of essay, one kind of paragraph, one kind of sentence, be able to solve one type of equation, multiply specific types of numbers, but we don't want it to be everything. We're teaching a certain thing, so we guess on that size. And the way I think about it is sometimes what's revealed on one of these things is that we guess too big, too small. We taught most of the territory, but not a little corner of it. And very frequently we've taught, you're trying to, the kind of weird thing about teaching, I guess, is you try to teach a blob by teaching specific points inside. You try to build this territory out from the inside, usually. So you'll learn certain things, reflect on why they're true, and you're kind of hoping to sketch out this area, but you inevitably fail or leave areas blurry. And that's what I'm trying to do in the follow-up thing. So I don't think of it as repeating any instruction. I think of it as new instruction that is fleshing out an area that we hadn't really properly fleshed out before. And so I think that, I can go on your podcast and say anything. And you have to either believe me or not, right? I could say, there's no reason why you have to believe me when I say. I think it's worked out okay with my students. They don't seem bored, even the kids who got it right. But I think I can tell a story about why those kids don't react in that way, why they're engaged as they are, usually. And it's because what's happening when I say, teach a worked example lesson about some more specific area? Kids are having a chance to explain why something's wrong, apply, their knowledge to a specific type of question that maybe they already know how to do, but they've never, we haven't featured it in the lesson yet, really, because of how that was revealed by it'd be a little bit weird if I, not weird, I guess this happens all the time, but I wouldn't devote this kind of, I wouldn't choose to do it again. If it was just a clone of something we'd done before. I'm always trying to hit it in a slightly different way, have a different kind of learning activity than when we did before. So that's the hope. I don't know. I think it usually works out. But the other thing is, if you keep it short, there's only so long that kids can get bored for. So, if this is a 10, 15-minute activity that you're doing to give feedback on a crucial matter, then how bad can it be?
Yeah, I completely agree, Michael. I'm always intrigued by this. The more I work with teachers, the more I hear differentiation being used as a way to scrap a load of really good practices, like because it's perhaps not suiting the needs of every single child, well, we can't do it then. So that gets kind of thrown out the window. But like you, if it's a relatively short time and it's not reteaching, I think it's super powerful. I'm really worried about this kind of almost it's like a game. As soon as you say something, people just throw about differentiation and you're like, all right, well, I can't do anything about that because it's impossible to differentiate perfectly. And it just, it concerns me. So I'm just interested to get your take, but that's great though, Michael. That's fantastic.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, because if it's a game, it's always possible to do that, right? Yeah, exactly. It's always like, I found it. Exactly. What about kids?
Exactly.
From New Jersey. They already know. They already know this bridge lesson. I don't know anything about New Jersey. New Jersey, for those in the UK, is right next to New York. It's where Bruce Springsteen is from, and other musical acts subsequent to Bruce Springsteen. And it's very close to New York. I'm not actually as provincial as many New Yorkers because I'm from the Midwest of the country. It's just a little bit of American spice just to give some color to
it. He promotes the idea we're a global podcast, Michael, so I like that. That's good, that.
Oh, that's great. The pushback I get from teachers when I talk about feedback is typically, what do you do when there's a million mistakes across a long test? And there's no great answer to that because it's not easy to get feedback on a big test with a big exam that's got like 40 questions on it and five kids got this one wrong. That's a harder question for me because I kind of want to say, well, there's no good way. It's hard. Like, how are you going to figure out what to focus on? There's things you can do, but your learning activity needs to get much cleverer because it's much more difficult to give feedback on something so varied. So that when you started, I thought you were going to tell me that.
It was, yeah. It's on my list as well. But when you back on in a couple of years' time, when I start having to re-invite guests on, Michael, you can answer that question. That'd be fantastic. All right, Michael, what's your third tip for us today, please?
My third tip is get used to asking what if questions after explaining something almost constantly. And the way, when I say get used to, get accustomed to, I think there's, in my own teaching life, there's two things about teaching that help me get better. And I think that this is, you know, goes to the heart a little bit of what makes teaching a challenging profession. It's some ways that I get better at teaching are by understanding more things. Better understanding some aspect of teaching or mathematics or whatever, or children. And another, but even the things that you understand about your subject, the classroom, pedagogy, research, whatever, it's so easy to forget them during the course of a busy year, right? And then that goes along, it's almost like I think of it as a sports analogy. As some more American color, you know, in basketball, you can be a student of the game and understanding it. But part of it is trying. It's a performance thing. If you can't bring it to the court every day, you're not performing at high enough level. And so there's kind of an intellectual side to why I think asking what if questions during explanations is very powerful. But for me, I have to kind of like put a sticky note on my computer, remind myself that this is something that I want to be accustomed to. Because if I forget, I sometimes, after a couple weeks, be like, why did I stop doing that? It's such an easy, small thing, and I'm constantly like trying to keep it together and make things second nature that are not naturally second nature to me. So I'm trying to get accustomed to it.
Can you give us some examples of these what ifs, Michael?
Absolutely, absolutely. So, but what do you think? Should we tell the story of like the intellectual story? No, okay, you said give an example of this. I've just finished explaining, a student has just finished explaining, I don't know. No, I, to go back to a previous thing, my student raises his hand to answer, how do you add two numbers to make 10? And says, I forget what I said before, 5 1/4 and 4 3/4. And I say, that's great. And what if we were trying to make 15? Or what if we were trying to make 14? Maybe that's the question I'd rather answer because just thinking quickly here, you know, 5 + 5 = 10, but you can go up and you can go down. And maybe what I would like to nudge this child to think about is to make a generalization. 7 + 7 = 14, go up and down. And then what if we're trying to make 100? What if we're trying to make 1,000? But the broader point being that what if questions are ways of supporting people in making generalizations. It's poking precisely on the generalization button in your mind. And going back to this kind of blob that I was tracing out in front of this camera, not so long ago, right? We try to teach a blob. We try to create a blob-like skill out of particular things. And in my vision there, you know, each particular thing is a question that a child successfully understands or has answered. And when I ask that child, what if, I'm trying to draw kind of a blob around that. I'm trying to get that kid to explore more territory, build a generalization around that particular point. So I'm trying to flesh out each particular question, example, idea that a child is having or understanding, and I want to get a little bit more territory. I want to get a little bit more. I want to build that into a generalization. Otherwise, it's just a question. It's just an isolated bit of knowledge. It's just a lonesome fact.
It's really interesting, Michael. Let me just reflect on this for a moment. So one change I've made to when I'm working with kids these days is I like to do a lot more kind of learner-generated examples. And I never used to do this. Everything used to come from me. But I reread Thinkers by Anne Watson, John Mason, and Chris and Liz Bills recently. And they have some really good structures in there for learner-generated examples. So a good one is give me an example of and another. So something like, give me an example of a fraction that's equivalent to 4/5. And give me another one. And give me another. And I tend to chuck a little twist at the end. Make that last example as interesting as you can. So to try and get kind of boundary examples. So I really like that one. And I also really like, they have one called additional constraints, which is something like, think of two fractions that add together to make one. So that's the first one. And then the constraint comes in, but the denominators need to be different. And then another constraint for your next, and the numerators need to be the same, and so on. But what I like, it feels like this will slot in nicely along there. It feels like it's kind of like a learner-generated example, because you've asked one question, they've come back with an answer, and then it's, okay, well, what if I changed it a little bit? What would you need to do to your answer? So I really like this, because what I like about learner-generated examples is they lead towards generality. They also show students' understanding really clearly, because particularly if you push towards the boundaries, you can really see whether they've grasped the concept or not. But after that big, long ramble, my question is, when do these come in to like a learning journey, Michael? Because my fear is if these are coming in the explanation part, it may be too much too soon. But are they coming after an explanation or come in after a bit of practice? When do the what if questions work best for you, do you think?
Well, I think about it in terms of distraction, right? I wouldn't want a what if question to distract from our understanding of, going back to this analogy that for whatever reason is stuck in my head this morning. If we're trying to draw a particular point on this map, we want to make sure I actually get the point. Mm-hmm. And we want to make sure everybody gets the point in the room before we start expanding. So there is a bit of a constraint there, right? We don't want to, if we've just explained something and I assess that in the room, not everybody has had it, and the first student that I call on seems to understand it, I'm not going to push what if, because I don't want to distract from the learning in the room. We can't generalize from something that we collectively don't yet understand well. Now, when I do a worked example routine, the way that I've kind of incorporated this is I think about this as a self-explanation prompt. In other words, I think about this as it's very hard. So self-explanation prompts are supposed to help students, support students from learning from examples. So if you have an example of something, a model paragraph that you'd like students to write in a style similar to, or if you have a procedural way to solve some problem and that there's an example of that on the board. Self-explanation prompts are supposed to help students find their way around that. And what if questions, I think, are examples of those things, and they're just easy to say. They're easy to, they don't require tremendous creativity to come up with. So when I'm doing a worked example, just to straightforwardly answer your question, students will analyze the example. And then they will discuss it. And often I will say to kids, okay, go ahead. Your first analysis question is about making sure that you can, your first explanation question is make sure that you understand everything here. Make sure that you understand the particulars. You've paid attention to everything. You're not dropping the ball anywhere here. And then the second question is, okay, now generalize it. So I guess the way I think about it is once we understand this thing, why not generalize? It doesn't need to wait until practice.
It's Really interesting. Again, I'm going to need to, it's one of those things I'm going to need to think where they fit in for me. I'd never thought of putting them in the self-explanation. For me, it feels like something that comes after some kind of teacher-directed practice. But to take your point, I don't see why it shouldn't come in early on. That's interesting, that Michael.
Well, let me make the case a little bit further, Craig.
Yeah, I mean,
not to put pressure on you. Okay, but just to make the case, how are students supposed to use an example for practice? Right? They're different problems. We've all experienced students who perfectly seem to understand an example and then are unable to apply them in practice. So how? I think some people think, oh, you just copy it. You just do the thing. But you and I know that even the slightest differences in surface level details are often meaningfully different to students when they're beginning learning. So it's not enough to say just do the same thing. An equation that looks ever so slightly different makes it impossible for them to do the same thing. So we are talking about generalization through and through. We are necessarily, when we say apply this example to this problem, we are talking about generalization. So some amount of generalization has to happen. And we do need to support students in making those generalizations. Whether what if questions are, you know, we could talk about that. We could talk about whether that's the right way to do it. But something needs to be done to help subsume these things under the same framework.
It's interesting, this. And just so I've got
that,
my head
that said,
around.
I think one thing that in your work, you would vary it very slightly, right? You'd do very small variations between examples and practice. And I think that we could do that also with what if questions. I think that's not very different from what you do, right? We could say whatever variation you would do in a sequence of problems in your approach, Craig, where you've got like a minimally different practice, we can do that too, right? We'd say, what if instead of 12, it's 13, you know?
Yeah, this is fascinating, this, Michael. Yeah, I'm gonna need to ponder where this fits in, because when you were saying this, I'm thinking, yeah, that's, so what happens if the 6 was a 12? What happens if the length doubled? It's this kind of thing that I would fit into the practice, but I wonder whether, it can slot in a bit earlier. You always make me think, Michael, which is why I wanted you on the show. That's brilliant stuff. What's tip number 4, please?
Okay, tip number 4 is to use partner work as a chance to recruit quieter kids to share their thinking. So the idea is that we all have students in our classes that are reluctant to share their thinking for whatever reasons, and it's good for them to share their thinking for various reasons. And we can talk about those various reasons on both ends. But one way of bridging that gap for the kids is, I think, if you ask a question and then ask partners to talk about it or to work on it, that gives me a very clear picture of what they're working on. And I can see them hopefully being successful. And I can go up to them and say, hey, great job. Great job, Craig. You did a wonderful job talking about this just now. Would you mind if I called on you? I'd like to call on you, actually. Now, would you mind? I'd like to call on you. Craig, this is brilliant. I'd like to call on you to share your idea with the class when we're discussing. I'm going to do that, okay? And every once in a while, a child will say, no. And you know what? That's okay. I'll say, are you sure? It's great. I'll just call. It's no big deal. If they say no, it's fine. I'm not going to get into a weird power thing about it. But sure, you know, that often works. That often works for me.
Right.
They'll say yes, and then I get to feature them in front of the class.
This is great. Right. Let's dig into this, Michael. I'm always fascinated by the practicalities. What would be an example of a kind of question you would ask to get them to then start discussing? I'm assuming it's not just your kind of straightforward, the answer to this is 7, or is it? Is it those kind of right or wrong questions, or is it more kind of discussion-based ones?
Well, it could be. There's no reason why it can't be. If I ask students to solve problems and they're doing it with partners and or on mini whiteboards or whatever it happens to be, there's no reason why I can't call on a child and say, "Could you tell us what the first step's going to be? I'd like to call on you for that." That's fine. It's also more discussion-based things. And you're right. I mean, I find more value in asking partners to discuss things that are more discussion-based because that, you know, it's right there in the title, discussion-based. It goes better if you ask partners to do something that needs partners works for. And it's also easier, more seriously, I want kids talking to each other very frequently. It's very often the case that I'll have kids in class that think, oh, I don't belong here. I am not as smart as the other kids here. I can't do the things the other kids can do. I'm just going to keep my head down. I'll do my work. And I'm just going to, this is not something where I'm going to, you know, speak up. And I had students like that in my classes this year, my 13, 14 year olds this year. This child, and there's tremendous benefits for getting kids talking to each other in this way, because it builds confidence. I think giving explanations is a great way to learn. And if you are terrified to share your ideas, you will learn less. And also feeling like you belong in a classroom. I think every classroom teacher would agree. That's often very important for some kids, to feel as if they belong socially with a group. It changes their ability to take intellectual risks in the classroom, and it makes it much easier for the teacher to talk about mistakes that might have been made or to support their learning in various other ways. It just feeling like you belong matters. So I will ask kids to talk about stuff together. Going back to worked examples, self-explanation prompts are a great thing for partners to talk about. Taking turns explaining things to each other. Okay, everybody, here's your questions. We just studied this example up here on the board. Here's what I want you and your partners to talk about. First of all, talk to your partner. Go through each step. Make sure each person understands everything that's written on the board for each step. And then what I'd like you to do is, first of all, answer this first question over here, which is, why did they choose to do this? Couldn't they have done that? And then what if instead of 12, the number 13 was in this problem? Instead of plus 12, it could have been plus 13. What would have been similar or different if they had done that? Ready? I've assigned partners. Go. And then here I am walking around the room, kind of like looking very casual, kind of just like I'm not paying attention, just hands in my pockets, walking around people. I'm not even paying attention. I'm just I'm sipping my drink. I'm going, you know, and then here I am. I happen to be standing next to the quiet child. And I'm like, oh, wait, I was just happened to be standing here. That's a brilliant point. Hey, could I call on you during the discussion just to share that? It's a really good point. People should hear it. Oh, yeah? Okay, great. Okay, and then, all right, class, welcome back. Okay, so there were great discussions, everybody. We're going to call on Tony first. Tony, why do you say, what would have been different if it was plus 12, 13 instead of plus 12, Tony? All right. And then Tony talks. And then 10 years pass, and he writes me a heartfelt letter about how that lesson changed his life. And he one day becomes a congressperson in America, and he dedicates a museum to me. That's the goal. That's the plan, at least. I'm like in step two of that plan.
That's what we're all in it for. I love it, Michael. Because my question I wrote down was exactly what you've responded to there. Like, what do you do whilst this partner talk's happening? Because there's a real danger we can get in the way, right? Particularly if you've got a quieter child, a shyer child, a less confident child. We could, as we walk round, they'll tend to shut down a little bit. Or maybe even, I don't know if you see this, like kids, when they see you close by, they want to almost perform. So they stop their kind of natural rhythm that they were having in their conversation. All of a sudden, it's a phony dynamic. It's different. They're not having that one-to-one conversation they were having. So aside from kind of walking around casually with your drink, how do you not get in the way, if that makes sense, but still be able to listen so you can pick up on these key insights? It's tricky, isn't it?
It is tricky. I mean, I'd say the thing that I try not to do is I know that we're going to have a discussion, so I try to be thoughtful about when I interrupt. I try to only interrupt if there's a real need, not just to correct a mistake that I'll be able to correct in the whole group in just a moment. You know, I think a lot of the other thing that I was there's an educator in Canada who has a book that is a hit in the United States. It's called Building Thinking Classrooms, and one of the things that he identifies in this book is the concept of I think he calls it proximity questions. Questions that students wouldn't ask, but they only ask because you're nearby. Like you're standing nearby, so they're like, I might as well ask. We don't know this. We're talking about it, but yeah, he's right there. So I'm trying. My body language is not. I've got different body language and ways of attending when it's clear that I'm looking for questions to answer, and when I'm trying to give room for people. I'm standing a little bit farther back. I'm not really making as much eye contact, and basically I'm not doing the things that I'm not acting the way I am. I'm not like poking my head in all the time. The way I am when I'm looking for questions to answer. I do have those different modes in the classroom. I do have, attention, question seeking mode, where I'm saying, who's got questions? I want to answer your questions. I want you to ask questions. Please ask questions. And this is a different mode. I'm standing back. I'm trying to think about how far I am. I'm trying to train them to be a little bit more independent in this way. Then again, I've had classes where they need me to be a little bit more attending. And any independence, any student independence is something that you're trying to help them become more independent, but they might not be ready for it yet. So it's a balance in that way too.
Fantastic.
I don't know.
All right, Michael.
Yeah, whenever you ask a hard question, I just talk. And it's because that's the way teaching is, right? There are things that are hard and solvable, and there are things that are hard and they're just hard.
Got it. Right, Michael. Fifth and final tip, please.
All right. So my fifth and final tip. I'm looking at my notes, and there's four tips here. Now you'd think, I'm looking at my document, the fifth one has been deleted. So you'll have to tell me. Before we talked, I shared this fifth one with you. It does exist.
I have bad news.
So I remember. I think I remember it.
Okay, you were, because I have bad news for you.
I remember you said one of them was...
I have bad news for you because I'm looking at your same document because it's a shared one and you've cut it off. So I it's a mystery to me. I can vaguely remember it, but it'll be a nice surprise for me what the fifth one is here.
Well, I remember before you told me that one of my tips wasn't as good as the other. And so we deleted that one. So I'm hoping I remember the right one. If this tip doesn't make sense, it's my fault. I mean, obviously it's my fault, but it's my fault in a bigger way. Anyway, I think what I wanted to say is I think that tip number five was when you call on a student, do not move on from that student until they have said something
that's
smart.
That's it.
Or
that
correct.
Is it.
Yeah, okay, good. Yeah. That's the good one? Okay, good. Right? And that's another one of those habits that I'm trying to constantly remind myself of, because I think it's a good one. I think it's something that I try to hold on to. It's one of those things that when I don't do it, I'm like, oh, I did it again. I moved on from a kid, and the last thing they said was wrong, and that didn't feel right.
How'd you do it, Michael? To talk us through this as an example.
Well, what I used to do is I'd call on a kid, and I'd say, some of the times I ask questions like the ones before, like, what are two numbers that add up to 10? That seems to be the one that's safe territory for me in this interview. I can always go back to that question. And so I say that, and kids like one and three. Like, so a very easy thing to do that I find myself falling into sometimes is I'll say, no, that's not right. Anybody else? Who else has an idea? Just trying to like steer away from the 1+3 idea, which is not true. 1+3 is not 10. So what do you do in those situations? And so what I've tried to do is I've tried to, and just to add on to why, like what's going on there, right? Because teachers are good people. I think what's going on there is, at least psychologically for me, I hear, 1+3 is not 10. And I think to myself, oh no, I need to get away from this situation. This is an embarrassing situation for this child. The more time I dwell on this child's mistake, the more embarrassing it's going to be. This child is going to, I'm going to, right? And there's so many bad ways to do it, right? 1+3, I'd say, no, what is 1+3 though? And they'd say 10, because they just said that 1+3 is 10. And I'll say, no, but can you, start with 1, Let's walk you through it. And what's 1 plus 1? 2. What's 1 plus 2? And it's going to go badly. And everybody, and there'll be snickers. There'll be kids going, while this kid's doing, it'll be whispers. And then, like, a kid behind will be like, say 10. Say 10. Say what? Say 1 plus 9. You know, say 4. Because kids are trying to save, because they're all also nice, trying to save their friends from embarrassment. Okay, so how, so, but, so every instinct in my head is saying, get away from this situation. And yet I think that that's sad because then you haven't given this kid a chance to be smart. And the last thing they've said is something wrong. And we don't even know if they're going to learn anything from it. So what can we do? So my goal now in those situations, I try to remind myself, let's get this kid to smart territory. And let's end when this kid says something smart. Because if you say something smart, it doesn't matter what you said before. That was wrong. That's fine. You've learned something and you said something smart. You're part of the community of smart people. We all understand math. We're all working on this together. But we're ending in the same direction. So how do I do that? How do I get this kid to say something smart? That's what's in my head. And I've got a couple moves. I don't have a ton. But one thing I do is I correct it for the kid. And then I shift to explanation. So I'll say, actually, 1 plus 3 is not 10. It's 4. Can you prove that it's 4 if I think that the kid can do it? Why does it make sense that it's 4, actually? And a lot of, it's a little bit risky still because the kid might not know. But very often, if you choose your battles correctly, the child, in my experience, has been able to say, oh, right, it's 4. Oh, yeah, because 1 and then 2 and then 3 and then 4. And there we go. Yes, brilliant. That's absolutely right. So can anyone build on what Ari has said? He's proven that 1 plus 3 is 4. So 1 plus what would be 10? You know, and I can kind of, it feels better. It feels better. The kids learned something. I've corrected it. And I think that's an example of how what feels like it might be meaner in some ways to say, no, that's wrong, can actually be kinder as long as it's not the end of the story. So quick correction and then new question, or sometimes an explanation, is powerful in my experience. So the paradigm is like wrong answer from a kid, quick correction from me, quick follow-up question that the kid can successfully answer now that they've hopefully realized something from feedback, and then we move on.
I love it, Michael. Did you say you had a couple of moves? Was that the two moves? Is it kind of quick correction followed by a follow-up question and quick correction followed by asking them for an explanation? Or is there another move up your sleeve here?
That's the one that works the best.
Yeah.
I think the other things that I do, I think more teachers would I think recognize as like familiar territory. What's the other one? Yeah, like, you know, a kid says 1 plus 3, you say, no, what's 1 plus 2? Yeah, that kind of thing is I think, trying to get a kid to realize a mistake that they've made by asking a question that they think that you think that they can answer on their own is, I think, more familiar territory. This is new to me. This is something that I don't know, that I need to keep my eye out for in my own teaching and see what comes up and try to kind of see what other moves I do have.
I love this. I love this, Michael. Just one final reflection for me on this. One of the things I find myself doing a lot or found myself doing a lot is what Doug Lamov calls rounding up. So this idea that a student says a wrong or an incomplete answer and you as a teacher have the critical part to make that answer right. And it feels great in the moment, but then you think, you know what, this isn't good, this, because the kid thinks they've actually understood something when in fact they haven't really. They've given like the incomplete answer. And then you've added the kind of key bit, and it's not checking for understanding. It's kind of a bit of a cover up where everyone's involved. But the thing about rounding up is the kid feels good at the end of it. But what I like about what you're saying here is you're not, you know, you're making it clear that answer's wrong. You're also not moving on to say, okay, I'm going to come back to you. Let me ask some other child, because that the kid's feeling a bit bad about themselves there. I like this idea that you're being really open and genuine, but you're giving them that other opportunity to feel successful in a genuine way. It feels really powerful. It's not rounding up, but it's not kind of almost like no opt out. It's not right, you've got it wrong, but keep listening, so I'm going to come back to you. It feels like this is a different strategy to that, that has the best of both worlds. You've got your kind of understanding, but you've also got the kind of motivational positive feeling. I don't know if that, any of that makes sense at all.
No, it makes sense. The thing I would add is that I think what makes this possible for me is when I started having a better understanding of the types of questions that I ask, it opened things up. Because if the only question you're asking is, the only learning question you're asking is, what's the answer?
Yeah.
What, or what's an answer? Then you are kind of stuck if a kid says something wrong. Or you can try to find a right answer. But when you expand things to explanation questions or generalization making questions, when you have a repertoire of another thing that I'll do is a quick correction, and then, so if the kid seems to be like, oh yeah, I'll be like, so why is that wrong? What's wrong with that? You just realized that it was wrong. Share that, please. You know, that's another, once you have, you know, once you can rattle off, which I feel lately that I'm better able to do, like, okay, well, you can answer a question, you can explain why something's right, you can explain why something's wrong, you can extend a question, you can do a what if question. When you have a repertoire of questions that you ask, then okay, we've knocked down one possibility for a kid. There's still, you know, four or five others that we could ask this child to answer that they are potentially capable of, and potentially now especially capable of, now that they have realized, oh, that's wrong. So I do agree. I do kind of, I think you nailed it. We're trying to have kids rounded up, I suppose. I mean, rounding up is not the image I guess I would use here at all. We're trying to orient everybody in the same positive direction, towards learning, towards understanding, towards contributing to our collective understanding. And a tool for doing that is giving feedback. And Here's a Lamavian thing, normalizing error. I mean, that's not just him, but normalizing error is part of the tool here, right? If error is a big deal, then we have to kind of like rear our way. But if it's just like, no, that was wrong, but let's talk about something, you know, something related to that. And just add on, because I kind of waffled a little bit earlier because I don't have a perfect understanding of how. I don't know if you feel this way. I feel like when I'm teaching, things come up and then I have to kind of like sift through it over the course of the subway ride home or whatever, and try to be like, did I do that? Does that work? Should I try that again? So I think another thing that I'm realizing as we're talking about this and I'm reflecting on this is, right, a quick correction sometimes works, but in the situations where that doesn't work, sometimes a longer correction still sets things up for the child, right? Right? 1 + 3 is not... It's not 10, it's 4. There's no aha that I hear. There's no, oh. I'm like, right? Because 1 + 1 is 2. 1 + 2 is 3. 1 + 3 is 4. So what would 1 + 4 be? Child. Right? Right? I've got a better shot there. If I've said a little bit more. So I can, my correction can be quick, it can be longer, but I'm always trying to end with the child saying something true.
Fantastic, Michael. Love that. Love that. Love these 5 tips. So just before we say goodbye, what should listeners check out of yours? What do you want them to take away?
Well, I do have a book. If you wanted to buy it, that'd be very nice. The book is Teaching Mathematics, Teaching Math with Examples from John Catt. And again, if you wanted to buy it, that would be very nice. I do have children. This would support us in buying Honey Nut Cheerios for them, which is their favorite food. They eat so much Honey Nut Cheerios. Other than that, there's nothing really of mine that, if you're interested in more of my things, by all means, I have a website, michaelpershan.com. I'm on Twitter, M for Michael, followed by Pershan, but that's all good. You can follow me or not.
That's great.
You don't have to support my Twitter habit.
I'll put links to your Twitter, your website, and your books will all be in the show notes. And again, we've spoken before on my podcast. You know, I'm a huge fan of your work and especially of your book. I think it's fantastic. So, Michael, all that remains me to do is thank you for giving up your time to be on the Tips for Teachers podcast. Always a pleasure speaking to you. Thanks so much, Michael.
Absolutely, Craig. Have a great day.